WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Tonight, from the White House, a special edition of Prime Time.
We have finally decided.
On Wednesday night, ABC featured a town hall style forum with the president about his health care plan. Before the special even aired, the newly formed Congressional Media Fairness Caucus, 40 House Republicans led by Texas Representative Lamar Smith, declared that there wouldn't be, couldn't be, enough challenge to the president and his plan. Smith went on to tell Newsmax.com that media bias was a bigger threat to democracy than terrorism or a depression. ABC's special was Exhibit A, despite some pretty tough questions for the president.
Your critics on the Republican side of the Senate Finance Committee wrote you a letter.
Would you potentially sacrifice the health of your family for the greater good of ensuring millions?
A little skeptical on cost, Mr. President.
What are you going to do for people like me so that we don't fall through the cracks?
Congressman Lamar Smith, welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you and your listeners as well.
So, having seen it, were your fears realized?
Unfortunately, yes. I think all ABC really did all day long, from their morning newscast to their evening newscast to the town hall meeting at the White House. I think all that amounted to just showing one side of the health care issue, frankly, as they have since January. ABC has interviewed 55 people in favor of the president's health care plan. Only 18 were opposed. They ought to be hearing about what is the Republican plan, tough questions about the president's plan, how is he going to pay for it, who's going to pay for it.
With regard to the special itself, did you feel he wasn't sufficiently challenged?
A couple of tough questions at the open forum does not equal both sides, particularly when the audience is being handpicked by ABC, and particularly when the president has home court advantage and gets to always have the last answer.
When you were on with Fox's Greta Van Susteren, you did compare the ABC special to a rigged football game. She disagreed, and she's a lawyer, so she likened it to a legal case.
It's almost like a direct examination was tonight. Tomorrow, everybody can cross-examine it. But for today, we wouldn't have that chance.
And the day after the event, Paul Ryan, who is the ranking Republican on the House Budget Committee, appeared on ABC Good Morning America to offer a response.
Yep.
And there have been responses from Republicans all over the media.
You know, one response by one member of Congress.
Is that all there's been?
The day after does not equal the all-day coverage by ABC the day before. They ought to give both sides the entire time, not just give one person or a couple of people the next day a few seconds.
Is the formation of your caucus intended to shame the press or, depending where you stand, intimidate it?
We just want them to adhere to their own journalistic code of ethics, which says they have a duty to provide a fair and comprehensive account of events and issues. And yes, by pointing out examples of media bias, we hope the media will be responsive and do what's right for the American people.
I understand that ABC News covered the inaugural event of the Media Fairness Caucus on Wednesday in the House Radio TV Gallery. Now, events in the gallery, I understand, need a broadcast sponsor, so you asked ABC to do it?
We did not ask ABC. They volunteered to sponsor us, but it was ironic that even though they agreed to have a camera there, which is all that is meant by sponsorship, ABC did not air one single second.
Congressman, who did cover it?
CNN was there, NBC was there, ABC was there. Nobody, to my knowledge, gave any coverage to the Media Fairness Caucus news conference.
And Fox News didn't even send a camera. It seems that this bias is very widespread.
No, the bias is really one-sided. When you look at the Gallup poll recently, only 9% of the American people think that the national media reports the news accurately and fairly. 9%. So the national media have a real serious credibility problem. Those same people, by the way, believe that there are twice as many instances of liberal media bias as conservative, and you see that on the network news.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Republican Representative Lamar Smith of Texas is head of the Media Fairness Caucus. David Westin is the president of ABC News. He says there are more than two sides in the debate over health care.
We had representatives there who were from Democratic persuasion, Republican persuasion, independents, doctors, private individuals who were patients, experts. And we did our best within an hour in primetime and then a half an hour of Nightline to present all sides of the debate. Implicit in some of the criticism is the notion that true journalism consists of having neutered journalists act as a referee between two opposing partisan viewpoints. And while there's some role for that in journalism, a lot of the best journalism is done by journalists asking difficult questions, probing questions, and making sure that people are held accountable and answer.
Lamar Smith says it's the media's responsibility to give equal time to the Republican alternative, taking it apart and giving people a chance to advocate for it.
As the Republicans propose a comprehensive alternative, be assured ABC News will cover that in depth and in the similar respectful but probing way that we've done with the president. It may not look just exactly the same.
And you won't have a White House.
We did, as a nation, elect this man president by a majority of the votes. And as president, he does have a different position than anyone else in the country. And when the president we elected comes forward and says, this is the number one priority for the country, I think we owe it to ourselves to pay attention to it. Not necessarily favorable attention, but attention to it.
Do you in any way see Congressman Smith's point about a perceived liberal bias among the American people?
Well, I certainly have read analyses that suggest that there's a fair number of Americans who perceive a liberal bias, and that has to give one pause. At the same time, sometimes people who criticize also have their own agenda. The Republican National Committee actually went out with a specific overture to raise funds based on the ABC News not yet aired town meeting. I am also mindful that there can be a certain gaming of the officials in this matter, that the louder people complain, the more they think we may bend over backwards the other way. Our job is to try to keep it right down the middle.
The Republican Media Fairness Caucus did hold a press conference that ABC News voluntarily sponsored in the TV radio gallery on the Hill. But it didn't actually air any of the coverage, says Smith. Why didn't anybody cover it?
Well, we covered it. We had a reporter there, and we reported it on our website. We have a limited period of time. We're not a cable news channel. And we make a decision, an editorial decision, about what merits that much treatment. And as happy as we were to sponsor this event, because we are for more speech rather than less speech, in the end, it didn't rise to that level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David Westin is the president of ABC News.
Last Sunday, Alicia Shepard, NPR's ombudsman, published a blog post that explored the reasoning behind NPR News' use of the term enhanced or harsh interrogation techniques rather than the word torture to describe the interrogation tactic known as waterboarding. The current administration has declared that waterboarding is torture. Former President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney continue to deny that. Shepard says that calling waterboarding torture is tantamount to taking sides.
Torture is illegal. So I think the media gets caught up in trying to figure out how to use this. And so the one point I hope I made strongly was just stop characterizing things, just describe what they are.
I should point out that as ombudsman, your job is to be the link between the audience and the NPR News Department. You aren't a mouthpiece for management. But in this case, you do seem to be sympathetic and supportive of the NPR policy, no?
I would say that I am sympathetic and supportive for good, solid journalism. And as I noted in the post, we've been getting a lot of emails from people who would prefer that NPR uses the word torture. So I felt they had built up, and I felt that it was time to deal with this.
The UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights says that waterboarding is torture. The International Committee of the Red Cross have called what the U.S. did torture. Waterboarding is unambiguously in violation of the International Convention on Torture, which has been ratified by 140-some countries. It seems to me that the only people who think it's a debate are the Bush administration, who are the culprits. So how does that constitute a debate?
Well, there are two sides to the issue, and I'm not sure why is it so important to call something torture. You know, when you describe the technique, I think that sounds like torture to me. Isn't it the job of the news media to put the facts out there, to give as much detailed information and to put it in context?
I put it to you that embracing a euphemism for torture validates a political position. You're trying to be apolitical, but in fact, to embrace terms like harsh interrogation tactics instead of calling a thing by its name in effect, gives credence to the Bush administration's argument, does it not?
Yes, I think it does. I think using terms like harsh interrogation tactics or enhanced interrogation techniques does validate the Bush administration. So that's why I said, why not just describe it? I think when you detail something and explain specifically what it is, then the public can decide.
NPR certainly has no difficulty calling murder, murder. It doesn't call it enhanced argumentation technique. The terrorists call themselves freedom fighters, but NPR calls acts of terror, acts of terror. In other respects, NPR hasn't taken a position against, you know, nouns. Why this one in particular?
I think because it is a hotly debated topic. Isn't that why any news organization is studying it, analyzing it, trying to figure out what's the right thing to do? I get emails from people who say, why doesn't NPR call a doctor who performs abortions a terrorist? Our language in general is totally evaluative and loaded with meaning. And so whatever someone uses, if someone else disagrees with it, then that language is wrong. So embedded in NPR's policy, it does say that we may refer to specific techniques such as waterboarding and note that the president and the attorney general have said that waterboarding is torture. So NPR does not have a never use the word torture in their arsenal.
All right. So obviously, I have a point of view on this, and you have given us NPR's point of view. Is there anything else you want to say before we close this discussion?
If I were asked personally whether or not pouring water down someone's nose and throat for 20 seconds constitutes torture, I would say personally that I think that it does. I totally understand, though, that a news organization needs to be as neutral as possible and putting out the facts and letting the audience decide whether something is good or bad, right or wrong. And so, in my opinion, as somebody with almost 30 years of journalism experience, it's not the role of the media to take on characterizing things.
Fair enough. Thank you, as always.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Bob.
Alicia Shepard is the ombudsman for NPR.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday in Iran, a group of protesters descended upon Baharistan Square near the Parliament building in central Tehran. That's about all we know for sure. We have shreds of information, mostly unvetted, like this disturbing phone call from an unnamed woman to CNN.
This is exactly a massacre. You should stop this. You should stop this. You should help the people of Iran who demand freedom. You should help us.
The New York Times wrote that it was, quote, difficult to ascertain exactly what happened on Wednesday. We depend for news on Iran lately on cries of distress like this, accounts and images produced by Iranians inside Iran, because most reporters have been forced to leave. Others, like Newsweek's Mazyar Bahari, have been arrested. Reporter Jason Rezaian was covering the elections and protests for the news site TehranBureau.com right up until he left Sunday night. He wasn't forced. He decided to leave. He's now in Dubai. He says he used to hear people refer to Iran as a fascistic state, but never thought that was true.
But the last two or three days that I was in the country, it definitely had that feel to it. I mean, you know, armed police on every single corner, people not being allowed to congregate, brutal crackdowns, beatings, the likes of which I didn't think were possible. On top of that, people that were being beaten, rather than being treated by doctors, nurses, or allowed to go away in ambulances, were being hauled off as prisoners.
There are two narratives on this story. One that's reaching the outside world as it pieces together the story of a crackdown on free speech, free assembly. And then there's the story that Iranians are getting from their state media.
It boggles the mind. As I was leaving the country, I was watching the state TV in the airport, and they were showing one of the besieged militiamen who, you know, we've been hearing so much about the last week or so, being beaten by protesters. And, you know, the commentator was saying, you see these protesters, these are terrorists, they're beating the defenders of our state, when the opposite is the reality of the situation. They just happened to catch some people taking out their frustrations on one of these guys. And the response from the people watching was curious. I mean, they were smiling.
Foreign reporters were essentially held under house arrest. That is, they were not permitted to leave their quarters to report what was going on in the street. Can you tell me what form that took? I mean, were there armed thugs outside of hotel rooms? How did they enforce this crackdown?
I can't speak to that too much because I'm an Iranian citizen, as well as being an American citizen. You know, I was living in my own apartment there, and I can tell you that nobody was standing at my door telling me I couldn't go out of the house. But when I did leave the house, I'd get calls, you know, you should go back home, from unnamed officials.
I want you to clarify that for me. You leave the house, your phone rings, and someone's telling you to go back home. You were clearly being shadowed.
Yeah. When you think about it, there's very few foreign news representatives allowed in the country in the first place. It's not that hard to keep tabs on us. Now, you know, we're hearing a lot of stories coming out of Iran that people are worried to speak on the telephone, worried that their emails are being monitored. That might be the case. I can't see how they would be monitoring everybody. But when it comes to foreign media, I think it would be very easy to monitor our comings and goings without too much extra effort.
Foreign reporters were asked to leave the country. Their visas expired, and the regime said, okay, time to go. You have dual citizenship. You, strictly speaking, did not have to leave, and yet you chose to do that. Why?
I chose to do that because I couldn't work. I had to give back my press pass to the Ministry of Islamic Culture and Guidance. I've been covering Iran on and off for the past 8 years, and I want to continue to do so. So I really have to be wise about the decisions that I make. I feel a strong responsibility to continue to get people's stories out. You know, I need to feel as though I can go back.
Jason, you're in the airplane. You're leaving Tehran for Dubai. The wheels go up. What's going through your head?
As I left for the airport, I had been told by friends earlier to be very careful not to get myself into the Islamic Republic's computerized flight system so that there was no extra time for them to check up on me. So the reservation was made from outside of the country. You know, I showed up at the airport with a confirmation number and checked in and boarded the flight. I'll be honest, the last thing in my mind was, do I really want to leave right now? Do I want to stick this out?
All right. Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Jason Rezaian has been covering the Iranian election for TehranBureau.com. He joined us by phone from Dubai. There is something like media convergence in the air. Two prominent young bloggers have joined the ranks of the mainest of the mainstream press. Ezra Klein, a 25-year-old liberal policy wonk, moved his blog to the Washington Post website, and Ross Douthat, a 29-year-old conservative writer, has staked a claim on the Times op-ed page. When the news of both hires was announced, it mostly passed without comment, except for in our office. We wondered if maybe these two had actually gotten a raw deal. Isn't it possible that by moving from their old haunts on the net to these creaky old papers, they actually stand to lose some of the influence that has gotten them this far? We're joined by Ross Douthat and Ezra Klein. Ezra?
Actually, I'm not sure the publication matters all that much. I think my audience is actually quite similar to what it was before I moved.
And Ross, how about you? You are now among the pantheon at the op-ed page in the New York Times. Have you found your place in the cultural conversation that you lost when you left the Atlantic?
There's clearly a difference. When you're blogging, you're participating in a conversation. That's what successful blogging is. You write something and it's an argument and people argue with you and you argue back to them and so on. And writing a weekly column, it's harder to just sort of float notions and see if people shoot them down. And you write a column and then people criticize it and you can't really argue back with them. So it definitely does take you out of a certain part of the political internet conversation. And the trade-off is that you have a much larger audience. I'm honestly not sure. I don't know what the influence trade-off is.
I don't know how many times you were posting per day, but it was a substantial number. Now it's one column per week. How has that changed your writing and thinking behavior?
The good side is there's a lot more space and time for what you might call deeper reflection, which will hopefully produce good columns. So I'm reading more books, for instance, than I was when I was writing two or three blog posts a day. And it'll be interesting, once I'm blogging and writing a column, what ideas go in a blog post, what ideas go in a column. Those are things I'll have to figure out down the road.
But there's something about the blog form that permits you, I guess, to be a little bit more speculative, maybe not to have ideas entirely nailed down. Ezra, if you accept that premise, is there a heightened sense of responsibility being attached to the Washington Post?
I do think you approach ideas differently, but I don't read op-ed pages. I think, my God, that is one set of entirely nailed down ideas day after day after day after day. I mean, some op-eds are brilliant and some are quite wrong, I mean, with genuine factual errors. So I think that there has been, in a way that may or may not always have been healthy, a cross-subsidization of the incredibly rigorous work that my reporter colleagues do on A1 and the work that happens on the op-ed and editorial pages. The credibility of one is cross-subsidized the other, but they end up in a very different product, much similar to what Ross does in his new job or what I do in my new oral job than to what some of the people who work near me, you know, publish on the front page each morning.
Although you're doing a lot of reporting, Ezra.
Right.
In addition to being a liberal policy wonk, you've become gradually a kind of deeply sourced reporter on Washington policy as well. Part of why your blog seemed like a natural fit for the Post probably is it sort of straddles the line between the kind of free-floating opinion mongering that I'm doing right now and the product that Post reporters put out every day.
On the subject of opinion mongering, columnists, Ross, usually get their jobs for about three different reasons. They're thoughtful, they are clever writers, and they've been on their beat or beats for years. Now, you're 29. Do you have anything that's kind of keeping you awake at night trembling that, you know, oh my God, I'm a fraud?
Yeah, I'd be a fool if I didn't. One way to look at it, though, is that there are strengths and weaknesses involved in what you might call the 30-year perspective. And I don't have the kind of deep sourcing and deep wells of experience that a lot of people bring to a column if they get a column at age 40 or 45 and 50. I'm not David Broder. I'm not the guy who's deeply rooted in the institutional culture of Washington. But there are also strengths that come with not being steeped in that culture. I think you're more likely to sort of be willing to stand outside it and question certain aspects of it in a way that people who are deeply sourced and who understand how the game is played and have been playing it for years and decades aren't. And I think that that's been one of the great strengths more generally of the blogosphere, that it's willing to sort of take the kind of sometimes clubby Washington consensus and say, well, this is ridiculous. This is just 50 or 100 people in Washington deciding what's reasonable opinion and what's respectable opinion and what isn't. And actually, there's a broader range of opinion that deserves to be heard.
Now, no doubt you have both noticed in trying to suss out how you're approaching your jobs, I've used as point of comparison existing column writing institutions. Is that even a fair way to approach this interview?
I think that something is lost when this interview takes place, or an interview like this takes place, too much in terms of older models, other columnists, other ways of doing things. I think that what you do see in the New York Times picking Ross, or in the way my work has been received over at the Post, is an engagement with models that have come up over the past couple, 5 or 6 or 7 years, on their own terms. And they're not anymore about whether or not you are or are not David Broder, or whether you are or not Bill Kristol. I mean, Ross has done, you know, pretty exceptional work on his own terms, sort of carved it out. It's why he was picked up in his 20s to be a Times columnist. And, you know, for better or for worse, my blog does something, I think, primarily that just had to do with the abundance of space available online, where I just would link to a lot of graphs and go pretty deep in ways that somebody who has to compete for space on a page, you know, genuinely can't. So I think there's something to be said for taking these models on their own terms rather than sort of fitting them into trend arguments that had to do with the rise of the blogosphere.
I basically agree with Ezra. Part of the story is just that the forms are changing, and I'm not sure exactly what they're changing into, but certainly the op-ed columnists and opinion writers of the future are going to be operating in some kind of mix of print and online and some kind of mix of the traditional column form and the blog. I think that both Ezra and I are sort of feeling our way towards whatever that model will be. But whatever it is, it will, for better or for worse, look very different than the columnist model of 10, 20 years ago.
Former Atlantic blogger Ross Douthat is now a columnist for The New York Times. Blogger Ezra Klein has migrated from The American Prospect to The Washington Post.
On May 27th, Ron Lieber, who writes the Your Money column for The New York Times every Saturday, wrote about the patchwork of student loan programs across the United States that offer loan forgiveness, often after a period of public service. Many of them had stopped forgiving due to budget cuts, despite promises to the contrary. The story was compelling but hard to cover because the loan programs are so disparate and so spread out. So Lieber and his colleagues set about calling every last state and federal loan program in a desperate bid to get their policy on the record by his deadline. When he had only 2 days to go, he knew he wasn't going to make it, but rather than put off the column, he decided to essentially bear it all in a very gray lady-like fashion. The resulting column was a hybrid, part mea culpa, part crowdsourcing project. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you took on this Herculean task of trying to find out what was going on in the entire rest of the country and to have it all ready to go for your column by Saturday. And you couldn't do it.
Well, no, there was no way we could do it, which is when we thought to turn to our kind of tribe of readers.
What happened?
A couple things happened. We got a phone call and several emails from people in California, mostly teachers, who said, this program is in jeopardy. We can't get any straight answers, but we bet you can. And oh, by the way, here are the people that you should call. So not only were we able to flesh out California on the table, we were actually able to publish a separate story specifically about California. Then we got another note from a guy who said that, you know, I and a whole bunch of people I know agreed to stay in the state of Arkansas and work in this specific technical field because of promises of loan forgiveness. And they've pulled the rug out from under us here, too. You know, one other important piece of information that came in, there were law schools, dozens of them possibly, who all have their own independent loan forgiveness programs for alumni. Are they going to end up getting their money now that some of those programs were funded by endowments that may be down 25% or 30%? We just don't know.
You put the call out to your readers to help you do your research, a classic crowdsourcing project, right? So what makes this so different?
With crowdsourcing, at least to my mind, you go out and you get the crowd to help source your story, to kind of lead you in the right direction, and then you finish it and you publish it. But what we realized is that we were not going to be done. And in fact, we could not possibly be done for weeks and possibly months. And there was no way we were going to speed that up unless we put this out not just on Facebook, not just on Twitter, but in the newspaper itself saying, we can't finish this unless you come and help us.
I think what you're doing is laudable, but you see it as a turning point, and I still need you to explain that to me.
Well, there's nothing in the New York Times style book that says specifically you have to be finished with your story before you publish it. But I think it's at least sort of an unwritten rule that the stuff's got to be done before you run it. You know, my immediate editor knew, and there was another editor who knew, but I'm not sure I quite explained to them the extent to which we were going to go out in public and say, we are not done. We need your help. Here are a bunch of blank spaces in our table. Please help us fill them in.
You learned firsthand that your readers are a wellspring of information and experience from which you can draw, something that many websites have understood for a long time. Is it simply that the Times isn't used to throwing it out to the audience in this way? Are you seeing the beginnings of a genuine convergence? Is this the great journalism of the future?
It's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. You know, the Times may, in decades past, have held itself out as being kind of all-knowing and all-powerful, but, you know, the paper's made enough mistakes in the past, and we've had enough trouble, you know, getting stories that, you know, I think there are very few reporters left who are so proud that they would not attempt to ask readers for help in this way if they thought it would be useful. And You know, Brooke, it's no great secret that at some point in the future, we may ask people to pay to use our website. And we think this sort of resource is something worth paying for. But we also think that if people are going to pay, they want to feel involved. They want to influence the outcome of the journalism. And this was really a way to do all of the above.
This paper has been liberated for the people with proper vetting.
Exactly. Well, it goes without saying, but it should not go unsaid, that everything that people sent to us, I mean, we called the appropriate authorities, we double and triple checked. It didn't just get thrown in the table.
Now, Bob spoke with Ross Douthat and Ezra Klein, and both made their bones as bloggers. Now they're working for the New York Times and the WashingtonPost.com. It seems that these two great papers are starting to embrace not just bloggers, but the blogging aesthetic. And that seems to be what you're doing, too, acknowledging that the playing field between news writer and news consumer has leveled almost completely.
Yes. Well, hallelujah, right? I mean, the age of the ink-stained wretch working in isolation is over, and I'm so glad it is.
Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times every Saturday.
Coming up, the pleasures and perils of the journalistic ambush.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Fox News' O'Reilly Factor has many claims to fame, among them its notorious ambush interviews. That's when a young producer stalks someone who has refused to come on the show, though some victims say they were never asked, and then descends on him in a semi-public place with a camera crew. Recently, some media watchers have noticed a surprising trend among O'Reilly's targets. They're all pretty obscure. Writing in the New York Times, Brian Stelter named a few of the relatively small fish that have been caught recently in O'Reilly's net. There was Mike Hoyt, editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, circulation 20,000. There was Hendrik Hertzberg, a New Yorker staff writer who's not quite a household name. And then there was the ambush of a relatively unknown blogger named Amanda Turkle.
Did you actually ever hear the Radio Factor segment in question?
Yes.
So what was the Mel Gibson component to Bill's analysis?
I don't believe I highlighted the Mel Gibson component.
Do you know what the Mel Gibson component was?
No.
Why not?
Because I didn't highlight it.
Because you didn't hear it, did you? Because you're just dishonest.
But if today the O'Reilly Factor can lay claim to the title of Ambush Central, it certainly didn't invent the technique. For that, most people put the credit, or perhaps the blame, on CBS's 60 Minutes, and specifically, Mike Wallace.
Well, come on out. No, just you don't want to talk to me? Why are you so reluctant? Why are you so reluctant?
We're going to get over here, Mike. We want to just get right over here.
I don't understand. They must be ashamed of something.
According to John Cook, investigations editor for the media gossip site Gawker, there is a significant difference between today's ambushes and the ambushes of yore.
The classic ambush style, usually there was some kind of public issue at stake. For instance, when Mike Wallace was going after someone who's renting an apartment and they're discriminating against African Americans, there's something of consequence at stake. And many of the ambushes that Jesse Waters has done for Bill O'Reilly are really about sort of carrying out Bill O'Reilly's personal vendettas against people who wrote things about him that he didn't like. And also, when 60 Minutes does it, they actually try to get the person under civilized circumstances to speak to them. They actually try to interview them. Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker and Amanda Turkle of Think Progress say they never had any idea that Bill O'Reilly wanted to talk to them.
So let's hear what that sounds like.
So after he refused to come on The Factor, we sent Jesse Waters out to see him.
Are you going to apologize to Mr. Gingrich?
No. Are you going to apologize to me?
For what?
for
for invading my pleasant morning.
So what's gained by this kind of confrontation if you're Fox News Channel?
Well, the theater is great, especially for Fox's audience to have some egghead liberal caught unawares and looking freaked out and frightened and confronted with the righteous ideas of Bill O'Reilly through his messenger, Jesse Waters. So it makes for great television. And it made for great television when Mike Wallace was doing it and when other people do it as well. And that's one of the reasons anybody does these things.
Now, this technique can only work, and the theater only works properly, if the ambusher has the presumed moral authority in the confrontation, as Mike Wallace did. By the time he shows up, you've already seen how bad the bad guy is who's been avoiding him. When Jesse Waters bothers Amanda Turkel on vacation or whatever, does he have that kind of audience sympathy, even Bill O'Reilly's audience?
I think he does, or they wouldn't do it. I think, by and large, with Bill O'Reilly's audience, there's a deliberate attempt to create heroes and villains, or whatever, patriots and pinheads, as Bill O'Reilly puts it. I know in Amanda Turkel's case, and if memory serves, in Hendrik Hertzler's case as well, it wasn't the first time that they had been mentioned on the show. They mentioned them over a period of days, and then there's this confrontation. And I think that's sort of getting the audience used to the idea of these people as enemies of Bill O'Reilly, as liars, as people who are spreading mistruths about him, and he's going to go out there and set things straight.
All right, so you decided to give Jesse Waters a taste of his own medicine. How did you go about doing that?
Well, it started because after the Amanda Turkel ambush, that got a lot of publicity and there was a lot of interest in this, and the New York Times did a story on Jesse Waters and Bill O'Reilly's ambush interviews. And there was something in there that leapt out at me, which was Jesse Waters declined repeated requests for an interview for this story, which I found obviously odd, given that part of his job is to force other people to answer questions for Bill O'Reilly, irrespective of
their
desires.
Well, you didn't find it odd. You found it hypocritical and predictable and just absolutely delicious.
Well, no, but I would say actually that I would think that if Jesse Waters sort of had his head screwed on straight, he would realize that the smartest thing he could do is just openly answer questions about it and try to inoculate the issue, whether it's to the New York Times or to us. But you're right, it presented an opportunity. So we decided we had some questions for Jesse Waters. So we drove out to his house at 6 o'clock in the morning with a video camera and waited for him to leave. And I consider it ungentlemanly to sneak up on someone the way he does. So we came up with an idea where we would be out there. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, we posted to Gawker a photograph of me outside Jesse's house saying, "We're here. We'd like to talk to you." And we have a pretty reasonable assurance that someone within Fox would see that, because I know the Fox publicity people read Gawker fairly religiously, and they've emailed me within seconds of things that I've posted going up. So we had a pretty good idea that he would be aware. So we waited for him, and he dodged us that morning because we're pretty much amateurs, and we didn't anticipate the urgent need for a bathroom break. I'm sure that's something that Jesse figured out long ago in his career of ambushes for newbies.
Two words for future reference, tag team, okay?
Right.
Okay, so the gag is pretty funny, but I'm just curious, how far into Jesse Waters' personal life are you willing to intrude to pay off this joke?
One of the ambushes that Jesse did was a guy named Bill Arkin, who's a columnist for the Washington Post's website and also an analyst for NBC News. And he had written something that Bill O'Reilly didn't like. And Jesse wound up tailing him for about an hour and a half across state lines. And when he found Bill Arkin and approached him, he was on some kind of family outing with young children. And Jesse walked right up to him and stuck a microphone in his face. That was pretty objectionable to me. It's clear from Jesse's MO that that's deliberate. They don't get them when they're coming out of the car at their house because they can go back in. They wait for them to get in the car and then drive somewhere. And they get them in a public space where they're unable to escape.
And most flummoxed?
Yeah. Especially if you're not someone who's accustomed to that kind of attention. And that's why they do it that way. So I'm not going to go on his property, but if and when we get him, we have to do it in a public place where he's out with his wife or something having dinner. You know, if that's what it takes, I don't see any real barriers for me to doing that.
That's John Cook of Gawker. He decided to have another go at ambushing Jesse Waters, so we sent OTM producer PJ Vogt to go along for the ride. Okay, PJ, what happened?
Well, we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we drove from Brooklyn. It was me, John Cook, and Gawker's video guy, Richard Blakely. I actually recorded it, so I can let John set the scene.
We're in Huntington, New York, and we're parked outside Jesse Waters' house. It's 7:17 a.m. on a Saturday, and Jesse's car is here, and his garage door is open, which is a very encouraging sign.
When we had first got there, we were really excited because the garage door was open. So we immediately had this theory that Jesse and his wife, Noelle, that they left it open because they were packing the car or something and they were going to come out any minute. And we sat there for almost 3 more hours. We were in this big black SUV with tinted windows, which John had rented because he thought it was less conspicuous than his regular car. About 9:45, the garage door started to roll down. And a couple seconds after that, you can hear Richard, the video guy, and he's really worried that she's going to see us. And John's whispering and trying to convince him that we're safe because there's these tinted windows on our SUV. Oh,
it's Noelle. It's Noelle. Window. Don't worry. It's tinted. She won't be able to see in.
She's coming by. She's coming by. Oh, my God. She's going to walk right by.
Okay. So you're staking out somebody's house in this gigantic SUV with the tinted windows. How are you feeling at this point?
Unbelievably excited. The thing I learned about ambush interviews working on this piece is whether or not they're good journalism, they're extremely, extremely fun. And then like a minute after that, after Noelle had come out, the garage door rolls back up and Jesse Waters himself comes out and then all hell broke loose. In this next piece of tape, if you listen, you can hear John say, "Oh, bleep, sorry." That was us getting tangled up in each other as we sort of fell out of the car and him slamming the car door on me.
It's Jesse.
Oh, my God.
Let's go.
Wait, let me get my...
Go.
Here you go.
Go.
I'm ready.
Oh, sorry. John Cook from Gawker, how are you? Mind if we ask you some questions?
How you guys doing?
Not bad. How about yourself?
Not bad.
Do you like stalking people? Hi, Noelle. Do you mind if we ask you some questions? Why won't you answer our questions? Are you scared to answer questions? Can we use your bathroom?
There ends my stalking adventure.
Okay, so you guys are kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight after sitting there for 5 hours. You can't get out of the car, and he gets away.
Yeah, well, John considered it a success because he felt like he made his point. I think the first thing that it's worth noting is that he broke or at least bent 2 of the ground rules that he laid down in his interview with you. We didn't post a picture on Gawker sort of warning that we were outside. And when we did ambush him, we ended up cutting across his property, which John had said he was reluctant to do. Also, by the time we got there, Jesse was just totally laughing at us. He saw us fall out of the car. So I'm not sure the operation totally succeeded.
I got to ask you this, PJ. You're doing this story because the presumption is that the Fox News Channel style of ambush is gratuitous and sleazy. And yet you've confessed that you were very excited about the whole thing. How do you square this circle?
Oh, I don't know. When we were on our way up there, I kept trying to interview John and I kept asking him some variation on the question. Did he worry that he was like the rogue cop who had broken so many rules chasing the criminal that he'd become the criminal? And he didn't feel like he had. But honestly, I think we tiptoed over to the dark side.
All right, PJ. Well, welcome back to the side of good.
Thanks, Bob.
PJ Vogt is a producer for On the Media.
If the ambush has fallen into disrepute, it had an honorable start, relatively speaking. Lowell Bergman is an award-winning journalist and educator who for nearly 15 years was a producer for CBS's 60 Minutes. During his long tenure there, he watched as Mike Wallace pioneered, refined, and then more or less abandoned the ambush interview. He says that showing up on the doorstep of reticent sources was a time-honored print reporter tactic, but nobody knew if it would work in the age of television.
The big question in the news business was, could you do that with a camera? What Mike started doing was confronting those people on the street, and that can be pretty dramatic. It's what Don Hewitt used to call that delicious moment. Mike came out of a closet in a number of cases and surprised somebody in an undercover operation. One of those cases, the Colonel Herbert case, led to a major First Amendment decision in the appellate court in New York.
Can you tell us about that case briefly?
There were allegations about his conduct in the Vietnam War. He sued. The case went up to the appellate federal court in New York and came back with it being thrown out and providing more privileges for us for operating in terms of and for fear of libel litigation. That became part of the signature moment of 60 Minutes, including the moment where Mike and now, let's say more recently, Steve Croft comes up on someone like a used car dealer after they've been surreptitiously taped talking about how they're going to cheat their customers, and then they confront them. All of that has really become a lot more entertainment and noise than really enlightening.
But you think in the old days it actually yielded more news and less heat?
There's nothing that says that news shouldn't be entertaining and get people's interest. But as Mike himself has said in the past, he stopped doing it really by the early 1980s because it had become a cliche. Everyone was imitating it. You had Geraldo chasing people down the streets. What's clear in the more recent controversies is that we're not really talking about news.
So let's talk about how it is used nowadays. Obviously, Bill O'Reilly, also Michael Moore. In some cases, this is commentary. In some cases, this is entertainment.
Yeah, in some cases, it's just simply titillation. You know, all of this began with programs in the old days called Candid Camera, showing people when they're off guard, when they're weak, when they're not expecting someone not only to come up to them and ask them a question, but recording it at the same time.
Do you think Mike Wallace may have taken some of his inspiration from Candid Camera?
Oh, I know he did. I've talked to him about it. Mike and some of the producers used it as a way to really dramatize what would often be either a boring story or B, a story you couldn't get on film without actually confronting someone. In the tobacco stories that I was doing with CBS, we were trying to interview the media consultant for Brown and Williamson Tobacco. He gave me some expletives and said, you know, there was no way that was going to happen. I called him back and I said, look, we also need your picture. We don't really have a picture of you. And I said, why don't you dress up the way you want to dress up and look on camera and walk down the street for us as opposed to us having to ambush you, right? He again blew me off. So we stationed a camera crew right outside his building in Manhattan. And it really was just to get a shot of him. He was startled by seeing that. And he walked right up to the camera and started talking to it. Made a great sequence in the piece.
Did 60 Minutes distinguish, and does it now, distinguish between true public figures and those who actually might be vulnerable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've got assets. They've got to worry about litigation. And privacy and other litigation can be very tough. An example is the primary Supreme Court case, as I recall, related to taking a camera crew into a restaurant to find somebody. The Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, CBS violated the privacy of everyone in the restaurant by just simply going in when the owner said leave. So the result is you won't see camera crews rushing into where people have an expectation of privacy. So there are rules of the road out there that normal news organizations will follow.
When Bill O'Reilly cites Mike Wallace as an influence, as he has, does he have a point?
Well, sure. Mike, to a certain extent, had a great flair for entertainment. He was a drama major in college, and he was the announcer for the Green Hornet and other radio shows. So the line between entertainment and, quote, news and broadcasting wasn't as developed until much later when he got involved in television. There's a real difference, though. Bill O'Reilly is not a news person. He's a journalist. He's an advocate. He's a personality. He's very wealthy and successful and good for him. But I don't think he can cite news standards for what he does. He's not interested in the other side of the story, and he makes that very clear in the way he conducts himself. And I don't think you could say the same of Mike Wallace.
Lowell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lowell Bergman is a producer and correspondent for PBS's Frontline. He's also a professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and was a producer for 60 Minutes between 1983 and 1997.
When it's least expected, you're elected, you're the star today. Smile, you're on Candid Camera. With the hocus pocus, you're in focus. It's your lucky day.
Smile, you're on Candid Camera.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Glodke. OTM is edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.